Patrick Midling is the sound archivist at the Belfer Audio Archive. Patrick came to Syracuse University in the fall of 2011. Prior to working for Syracuse University, Patrick was a graduate research assistant at the Digital Media Archive at the University of Chicago, where he worked on the digital transfer and preservation of legacy formats and developing and implementing metadata standards for the archive. Jenny Doctor took up her position as director at the Belfer Audio Archive in the Special Collections of Syracuse University Library in January 2012. She's also associate professor in Syracuse's S.I. Newhouse School of Public Communications. Jenny had previously lived in the UK since she was awarded a Fulbright grant in 1989. She spent much of her time rummaging around the BBC archives, resulting in the BBC and ultra-modern music 1922-36, Shaping a Nation's Tastes. And with Nicholas Kenyon and David Wright, the anthology of the Proms, A Social History.
Thank you, Martha. That's great. Good afternoon. I just wanted to say one thing. Are we okay on time? Because, okay, we're fine. The Belfer was founded in 1963 with the purchase of 150,000 recordings collected by the Bell brothers, who owned a record shop in New York City. The first director was Professor Walter Welch, and his focus was not necessarily on collecting sound recordings, but in preserving their content. As we heard a little bit about him this morning, a pioneer in audio preservation, Professor Welch developed the Thomas A. Edison Re-Recording Laboratory, through which he applied scientific theories to direct the playback and preservation of historic sound recordings. There was some discussion this morning about he took a very particular point of view towards the history of audio. In 1982, the Diane and Arthur B. Belfer Audio Archive and Laboratory was opened on Syracuse University campus, a bunker-like building just east of the library. It is believed to be the first facility designed specifically for the study and preservation of audio recordings. The building includes several floors of storage space designed for the conservation of sound recordings, a classroom, and also a recording studio with two control rooms, one of which now serves as the preservation studio. Under Welch and his successor, Bill Storm, the archive developed an extensive collection of historic sound recordings in all formats. However, in 1992, we're losing light here, the universe, I can't actually read. Sorry. Sorry, I should have this memorized, I know. Ah, thank you. Thank you, that's great. Okay, so we have an extensive collection of historic sound recordings in all formats, which are outlined on the screen. However, in 1992, the university severely cut back its support for the Belfer, reducing to skeletal staff and curtailing its collecting potential. Since then, the Belfer has received several grants to provide access to its holdings. Through the most recent, an Andrew W. Mellon Foundation grant, the Dean of the Library and the Senior Director of Special Collections have pioneered the regeneration of the Belfer as an archive dedicated to the use and preservation of sound recordings. The Mellon Foundation grant has enabled the redevelopment of the Belfer classroom into an up-to-date facility with SmartBoard 7.1 surround sound and other equipment that is used by classes from several departments of the university. It has also resulted in the hiring of an archivist, Patrick Midling, and the appointment of me as director. Responsible for audio digitization is the Belfer's longtime audio engineer, the highly experienced and knowledgeable Bob Hodge, who is with us today. In the remainder of this talk, first, the Belfer's archivist, Patrick Midling, will talk about a number of archival initiatives that the renewed Belfer is pursuing, and then I will describe a few projects that I am developing in my role as director. So over to Patrick.
Thanks, Jenny. Today I'd like to talk about my role as the archivist and what I've sort of envisioned as calling a real working archive. Earlier, Jenny just spoke about the cutbacks at Belfer, and these cutbacks in staff resulted in a growing backlog of material with a minimum of bibliographic control of that information. The Mellon Foundation grant called for an archivist who had knowledge of the digital transfer process, description, and could work across library departments to move the preservation aims of the archive forward. They hired me. I view my role as making sure that the archive works on a day-to-day basis, making sure that the patrons and researchers get the information they need, make sure that the collections are accurately described, our metadata are correct, consistent, and complete. In my portion of this talk, I'd like to address three projects that are either ongoing now or are currently underway, which will serve as models for future projects. To be entirely honest, I've actually planned or helped plan projects through the fall of 2014, but one must start somewhere. So the three projects are how to deal with multiple holdings of the same items in the archive, a survey of our tape-based collections, and what we've called the stream team, of which I was appointed chair in April. There are three types of multiplicities in the archive with respect to our 78 RPM records. The Rigler-Deutsch index multiples, henceforth the RDI, the post-RDI multiplicities, and multiplicities that result from new donations. First, we'll talk about the RDI. The RDI is how most of our 78 RPMs are arranged in the archive. The RDI call numbers for Syracuse are prefixed with NSYU, New York, Syracuse University. The RDI are found in our online catalogs and allows patrons and outside researchers to find items and submit listening requests on site only. The problem, however, is that multiple RDI numbers can refer to the same recording. It truly is a tale of at least two RDIs. So here we see two records from Summit, our catalog. You'll see that the main titles show minute differences, but as we dig down into the record, we see the items are identical. The same matrix numbers, the same titles. The display differences are due to how the MARC machine-readable cataloging record was created. Everything else the same. Furthermore, on visual inspection, the M925 on the record on the left is actually M925-1. They are identical disks, but more importantly, the NSYU numbers are completely different, and these albums in our archive are stored several ranges apart. So the question is, why? So we have proposed a system to rectify this situation. How have we proposed to rectify this situation? By determining a better way to organize the archives. As a side note, the commercial 78s are in a process of being fully cataloged under the auspices of another grant by our cataloging department. This means that some 78 RPMs are cataloged and some are not. This is an important part of dealing with the RDI multiplicities and the post-RDI, for that matter as well, because we need to accommodate for this. So when we find multiples within the RDI, we've adopted the following procedures. Regardless of whether a disk has a full catalog record or not, only one RDI can remain in our catalog. If a disk is cataloged, the RDI number has been chosen for us. If the disk has not been cataloged, we have decided, arbitrarily, to use the lowest number. The other copies will have their RDI numbers retired, and by retired, I mean it will no longer appear in the catalog for patrons to find. Its record will be suppressed in the back end. A place marker will be created and inserted in the place where each copy was pulled, referring one to the RDI number that persists. The place marker will also include relevant information, relevant metadata, the title, artist, record label, matrix numbers, etc. All of the copies, that is, all of the multiples that we find, will be compared for the condition of the disc. The best copy will be copy 1. The second best copy is copy 2. If the disc has been cataloged, I will create a second record in our cataloging system for the second copy and barcode it. It will then be reshelved in its new home next to copy 1. Both discs will also be labeled to reflect the new RDI number. Clearly, just as it is common to have 2 copies of a record, it is also common for us to have 3, or in the case of the Romeo and Juliet piece I showed you, 4. As yet, no policy decision has been made about these duplicates, and we have designated a place in the archive for these discs until such policy has been determined. At Belfort, we also use a system we've dubbed the post-RDI. The numbering is similar to the RDI numbering, with one minor exception: one number, one disc. Those of you who remember RDI know that it's one disc, an interval of 4, which refers to pictures on a microfilm. Picture of the label, picture of the disc, picture of the label, picture of the disc, and they'll have 4 separate numbers, but it's still one disc. The number is similar. The same procedure will be followed for the post RDI as the RDI 2 copy process. The third source of multiple copies comes from donations and donation requests. When we receive a donation request, we generally ask the potential donor to provide an inventory. The inventory is then compared to our catalog by our staff. Items not in the archive's holdings are immediately accepted. If we have 1 or more copies of a disc on the inventory, we will do a condition check on the ones in our archive. If our copies are in excellent condition, we tend not to accept that part of the gift. If our copies are in poor, fair, or even good condition, and there is a chance that the potential donation disc is in better shape, we will accept it. The accepted discs that are not in the catalog will be given new post-RDI numbers and sent to cataloging. The copies will then follow the processes outlined above. The second project is one that we've just started this month. Its stated goal is to develop a long-range preservation queue based on condition. By preservation queue, I'm referring to the digital transfer of those items. This project is a small-scale analog of the IU survey and project with which Mike Casey just spoke about. We are beginning with our reference collection because they constitute a large part of our tape-based collections, and we've already seen some degradation in those tapes, sticky shed mostly. The reference collection, as we've termed it, is comprised of the tapes that were created through the preservation process by the previous custodians of Belfort. The survey team is comprised of Belfort staff, that is myself, Jenny, and Bob Hodge, our audio engineer, and a group of student workers and interns from the iSchool at Syracuse University. The survey will serve as a pilot and model for surveys of our other collections by helping to define our workflows and assessment documentation. Briefly, the information from the tapes is currently in a card catalog in my office. The information from the cards will be entered into a database that will help us track the contents of each tape. Each title on the reference tape will be searched for in the catalog or our finding aids. If the original titles are not in the catalog or finding aids, the reference tape is then deemed an item of record and is considered an original for us. The tapes and originals will both be checked for condition. If the condition of the original is deemed better than the reference tape, the original will be placed in the queue. Clearly, tape originals will be placed ahead of more stable formats. If the tape is deemed in better condition, the original will be put in a queue for long-term storage for its preservation, and the reference tape will be put in the digitization queue. This will, 1, help us determine the number of items whose digitization is critical to the preservation of the content, and 2, will help us to plan for the long term with respect to the digitization of these items. The last project that I want to talk to you about is our stream team, for which I was chosen as chair. The goal of the stream team is to advise, propose, and see through the implementation of a means for the streaming delivery of special collections material, which includes our material, as well as other library material, into SU classrooms and other campus uses. I've set the goal for this project to be the beginning of the 2013-2014 academic year. The stream team is a cross-departmental committee composed of stakeholders from Belfort, Special Collections, the Preservation Department, Access Services, the Copyright and Information Policy Office, and subject librarians. The appointment of Belfer staff as the head of this committee is illustrative of the library's commitment to the return of the Belfer Audio Archive. The ability to share our audio will highlight our holdings and make the use of our material more accessible to faculty, researchers, and students on campus. Of course, you may have noticed that I stressed on campus twice. I was unfortunately unable to make it to the pre-workshop conference yesterday, but the copyright question is an ever-present one. And current legal discussions about the federalization of copyright laws and the status of pre-1972 sound recordings are important parts of any streaming solution and will definitely affect the access to any and all material that we put on said server. We are excited to be moving forward on the delivery and access, as well as striving toward the real working archive ideal. By doing this, we hope that once again the Belfer Audio Archive will be a source of pride for Syracuse University and the sound archives community as a whole. Now back to Jenny. Thank you.
As part of the university library's emphasis on scholarship, when the university prepared the Mellon Foundation grant, they decided to search for a director who would be able to function effectively within the archive, but whose outlook was such that they would also be part of the university's faculty, thus putting the use of the Belfer at the center of its revitalization program. Thus, I, a musicologist, have been appointed as the director of the Belfer, but also as a tenured associate professor. One of my main functions is to serve as a liaison between the Belfer and the academic community. The point is that the collections in the Belfer Audio Archive are to become central to academic studies across campus, so that the Belfer itself plays an active part in the scholarly community at Syracuse, rather than deemed as tangential, or even worse, as dormant, a state the place was approaching for so many years, while severely underfunded and virtually ignored. In order to revitalize the Belfer's role within the academic sphere, several projects are unrolling. Oops, I forgot to show you. Oh, here we go. For several years, a program has been in place through which the cylinder recordings have been systematically digitized and cataloged to enable internet access of the audio material in several digital formats through the Belfer Cylinders digital connection, and you can get to to those recordings online through that website. Starting in 2011, the Soundbeat Project has been issuing 90-second radio programs based on individual sound recordings held in the Belfer collections, usually cylinders or 78 RPM discs. The Soundbeat programs are aired weekdays on a number of public and other radio stations across the country, and they are also available on the website soundbeat.org, along with a backlog of previously aired shows. We are currently reviewing the collection development policy. Whereas in the past, the Belfer's goal was to collect any audio recording covering the whole history of recorded sound, we now acknowledge that that is an unrealistic goal. We are developing guidelines for collecting, taking advice from a faculty advisory group that I'll discuss in a few minutes, as well as from other expert advisors. Some collection priorities that we're clear about involve continuing to gather cylinders and 78 RPM discs, and also collections of broadcast recordings, complementing our holdings of Dick Clark, Mike Wallace, Long John Nebel, and local stations WSYR and WAER. In addition, we collect other unique recordings, such as those of film composers Franz Waxman and Miklos Rozsa, of photographer Margaret Bourke White, of baby doctor Benjamin Spock, and many others. I am forming an academic advisory group drawn... I'm not sure what happened. I'm so sorry. Can you get it to go? Okay. Okay. Okay, so I'm forming an academic advisory group drawn from a number of departments across campus so that faculty become invested in some of the future decisions that the Belfer will take. In particular, the group will be involved in discussions concerning the collection development policy to ensure that collecting serves faculty interests. I think that's quite important. And it will also consider access to the recordings, as that has such a great effect on classroom use and faculty research. This has been a great barrier to the Belfer in the past, and I am delighted with faculty enthusiasm in making the Belfer's recordings and the physical place itself more a part of campus life. Toward that end, we are involving ourselves as much as possible in classroom instruction, both one-time instruction sessions or major class projects that involve Belfer recordings, and that involves the whole team of us, Bob Hodge and Patrick, and several other people as well as me. Several classes have been involved with the creation of SoundBeat programs, and the SoundBeat class partnerships have provided an outlet for teaching situations which focus on writing about music and its cultural context in a particular journalistic way. In addition, when the music itself is under scrutiny, or the recording is, that brings it to our ears after so many years from when the recorded performance took place, then But classroom collaborations are in order. For instance, I am working with a professor who is soon to teach American popular music 1850 to 1950. He would like to provide for the final comparison project a number of examples of recorded performances of single tunes from different artists at different times. Another professor is interested in finding historical performances of choral music for her choral conducting class to analyze, in addition to discovering examples of SU choirs of the past, as well as choral music in the Belfer Cylinders and 78s. We are also able to choose examples from the archives of the Greg Smith Singers, which are held at the Belfer. This kind of activity may seem an obvious role for the Belfer to play in the musical life of Syracuse University, but the fact is that it had not been playing that role for some time now, if it ever did. Through these faculty activities, the Belfer becomes an active part of the campus community, which is really necessary to its relevance and continuation. Many people are vaguely aware of the Belfer as a gem on the campus, but they perceive it as a great mystery. What exactly is done at that building, and what recordings are held there? With that in mind, the Belfer is at the center of a plan which will not only increase faculty and student awareness of the archive and its holdings, but will help to improve communication between the various musical elements on campus, which are wide-ranging and currently badly out of touch with each other. Using the Belfer's holdings as a catalyst, musical interests will come together for an internal conference during autumn 2013, the Belfer's 50th anniversary year. This event will focus on a particular group of sound recordings that have been selected for their scope in provoking different interpretations. Various faculty members will prepare classes in different departments to analyze and interpret these recordings from their own particular scholarly perspectives, and they will come together with others from other parts of campus who will cast entirely different light on the same recorded objects. The point is to communicate different kinds of findings by interpreting light objects in multidisciplinary ways. Music history, recording history, music business, arts journalism, music education, etc., will all meet and communicate in a rich scholarly exchange using Belfer recordings as the central focal points. Thus, the Belfer will celebrate its 50th anniversary at the very heart of a project that will draw together various strands of the campus community. The next step, which we are beginning with this presentation today, will be to reach out more effectively to the scholarly community beyond Syracuse, making the Belfer and the sound recording archives like it more useful and integrated within communities that value them must be our united goal, ensuring their continued existence, supported by adequate funding, and thus tinting soundscapes of the future in the digital age with our analog sound heritage of the past. Thank you. Any questions?
Yes, I have a question about the RDI recordings. Yes, the RDI recordings that are in your It's the other way around, isn't it?
Is it working?
We loaded it.
You got a red light or a green light?
I don't think I'm supposed to. That's okay. The RDI recordings that are now in your catalog and taken from Arlen, you did, were they taken from the Arlen database? Or?
If that's from the microfilms, if that's the database you're referring to.
Yeah, is that where they were? So you haven't done any more cataloging, because those were like quick and dirty.
Right. So,
yeah, I was just curious.
To explain a little bit, when I mentioned that some of them have been fully cataloged and some of them haven't.
Right.
In order for the disks to have any representation in cataloging, the RDI skeletal records were incorporated into Voyager, our cataloging system.
Right.
And so, based on that, you know, all of the 78s have some sort of representation.
Right.
As long as they were part of that database.
Right.
What has happened with some of them, and this is due to another Mellon grant that Syracuse University received for the cataloging department, was the batch cataloging of DECA recordings and Columbia recordings. And so when I refer to some having full catalog records, those records have been pulled, sent over to cataloging, and names have been checked. The two sides have been unified into one bib ID rather than having, you know, one side, one record.
Right.
The goal ultimately is to continue using the RDI number as a call number for location in our archive, but the ultimate goal is to make sure that those skeletal records, those skeletal bib records, are replaced by fully cataloged, fully vetted bib records.
And if I can just add, those fully cataloged records are then being uploaded into OCLC.
Right. And so the ones that you did catalog fully were part of that Mellon grant, because I was formerly with New York Public Library, and we were the ones that were part of that Mellon 78 RPM. And you came in, I think, on the last year, right? Yeah, okay, you're too new probably, right? So I think those are the ones that were fully cataloged, those parts that you were talking about, right, as part of that Mellon grant. Right. So then the rest of them eventually, as you can do them.
Right. So the workflow goes a little bit like this. If we get a listening request, or we get a professor who wants to use sound recordings in their class, as part of the workflow, when that gets digitized, the end result is, if it hasn't been cataloged, I send it to catalog. This also goes for SoundBeat. When SoundBeat gives me a list of things to pull, the record hasn't been cataloged, it's sent to catalog. Whenever we can, we get things to people who know more than we do about actual cataloging of those items.
Great.
For research.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
I found it interesting that the example that you showed of the two duplicate records there, you mentioned that you checked the matrix numbers. However, the matrix numbers are specifically not on those records. Matter of fact, the card in both cases says matrix number not found. The tape numbers, which are on those disks, were not compared.
If I can just say, matrix number not found means that it wasn't visible from the RDI photograph.
It's not on the record.
But
I can tell you the matrix number is not on that particular record. The tape numbers are on the record, and that is not on, and that is, it says matrix not found. You have the record number, you have the set that the that is from
one of those,
but you know that inside
one of those is the matrix
925, and it's record 11-823 or one over the A size. Matrix not found.
Right.
The take, however, is on the record. Have you compared the two takes? Those might not be identical records. If
as I said, sir, I visually inspected these discs, and they are identical. I can explain why this says matrix not found. Now,
that's
the reason that this says matrix not found is because these are two RDI catalog records. And it was quite often that on...
I don't have to yell.
I know.
Okay, so the reason that this says matrix not found is simply because these are RDI skeletal records that have been uploaded so someone can find them by their call number. Now, also because MARC records are very boring to look at, I didn't include those records. I actually just have a different view of those. If I'd included the other view, you would have seen that information. However, in order for me to come here today and tell you that we have the same record with two call numbers, what I needed to do was go there, take a look at the albums, and see that everything actually was the same.
Did you compare the tape numbers?
I compared every bit of information on those discs.
Did you compare the tape numbers?
Yes.
The tape number at 9 o'clock?
Yes. Everything that was on that disc that is visually you can see was compared side by side by myself.
As I know how RDI was put together, I was part of the association, I was president of the association at the time, and I know that they did not put tape numbers unless it was attached to the matrix number. That was part of the system of putting it together. But the thing is, now that you've got the discs in front of you, you need to check the tape numbers before you decide
and to discard
them.
And we have.
Well, and no one's talking about discarding. As I said, what's happening is we're doing condition checks of all of our commercial recordings. We have decided by policy that we're going to keep the two best copies. No decision at all has been made about what to do about other duplicative copies. And what I've said is that those copies will be put in a part of our archive. They will be stored until those people who have, those stakeholders who have the best ability to make those policy decisions, you know, I will contribute to it, Jenny will contribute to it, the senior director of special collections will contribute to it. But once that decision is made, once that policy is made, we'll move forward with doing something with those records. But sir, I would not have the audacity to come here to this conference, tell you these are the same, without having actually seen it by my own eye. Okay. That just would have been irresponsible and just not good archiving.
Okay.
Okay?
It is that there are an amazing amount of alternate takes on these classical sets.
Yes, there are. Yes, there are, which makes attention to detail one of the driving forces.
Patrick, are there other questions? Yeah. Steve.
It sounds like when you're doing these comparisons, that every time you have to check something, you actually have to go to the physical object for condition, to check, to compare condition. Have you considered, and if not, why not, including condition on the catalog card of, say, the first one, and adding to it or upgrading, depending on what you find the first time as you compare, so that you don't actually have to physically go to the shelves every time?
Well, that is an excellent point. And yes, we are starting to do that in various spreadsheets that we are creating. But the fact is that we have inherited a lot of past practice that we are, you know, trying to find ways forward. But it's obviously an excellent point, and we are doing that in other projects that we're working on. Thank you. Yeah.
Two questions alone.
What is wrong?
You have discovered that the other ballroom has a master switch that they keep hitting.
Not to belabor the point, but